I find it really fascinating how everything that we talked about really comes back to the community. It's this grassroots, bottom-up model, stepping in for nature, really, for conservation, where, you know, governments failed, where there was just not enough funding and people were like, no, this is special to me. I'm going to fight for this. And you already touched on how many community groups are out there in New Zealand. It's just simply mind-blowing. And it's amazing to create a platform for them. And it's amazing to see that it's now regional-based and hopefully leading up into government changing for the better. So if BCA and the community groups didn't exist, what would happen to our biodiversity?
Yeah, well, I think particularly if the community groups didn't exist, I mean, I would actually hate to think what that looked like. I mean, as you've just mentioned, you know, on a daily basis, we're inspired by the communities, you know, doing good things and the passion that they kind of hold. And sometimes it's really hard for them and, you know, we can kind of walk beside them and hopefully help them get through the tough times to come out to the other side. I think there's huge power in community, and multiple benefits for those communities beyond just the conservation outcome. So, you know, we all feel, you know, better when we connect with like-minded people because it gives us a sense of place and belonging. You know, sometimes we need that, you know, all our lives, there are different challenges that we face. And so having something that we feel we are giving a positive contribution to the world, and we can tell our grandchildren one day, you know, I started that planting and, you know, look at it now, it's become a forest and actually Kōkākau have expanded into it. Or so to lose all of that community passion and drive for me would be really, really tragic.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified. Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space. I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna, and today we're joined by Michelle Elborn from Bay Conservation Alliance. Welcome, Michelle. Good to have you on.
Kia ora, team. Thank you for having me. Real pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Hey, I'm real excited for today, but before we kick off, just a brief moment for transparency. I've been an active member of one of BCA's member groups for a while now, and I've recently joined the board of Bay Conservation Alliance as well. So I've been at the receiving end of the amazing mahi that you guys do, and I'm just excited to share your message and amplify what you do for conservation.
So with that in mind, would you like to start by introducing yourself and the role that Bay Conservation Alliance plays?
Yeah, thank you. So tēnā koutou katoa, ko Michelle Elborn toku ingoa. So I have the pleasure of being the CE of Bay Conservation Alliance, or often called BCA, and we are an incorporated society really with a purpose and a drive for empowering communities that restore nature.
Cool. That is fantastic. Really love it. But why start, as I understand it, you're an umbrella conservation group and you support the communities and people around the Bay of Plenty that help nature. Why start an umbrella organization in the first place? Like, why is this needed?
Okay, yeah, so a key person I really want to acknowledge is the chair of BCA, Julian Fitter. And so he started up one of our now member groups, Makatū Ongaturu Wetlands Society, and quickly sort of realised that community conservation groups were working in isolation here in the Bay of Plenty, and as is quite common across the country, and really sort of saw the value in collaborative working and bringing people together to share that learning and drive that inspiration across communities. He was the driver. He spoke with a number of what I would say are the other sort of bigger community conservation groups in the Western Bay of Plenty. And they became our foundation member group. So that was Makatu Wetland Society, Otaniwanuku Kiwi Trust, Uritara Estuary Managers, which is now Project Padawari, and Ongititi Forest Project. So their BCA was born. And I like to sort of say it was founded by community for community. And that's really how we've kind of continued to evolve over the last 7 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I know that it's constantly growing and evolving. But before we get into it a little bit further, what does community conservation actually mean? What's it about and how is it different to your traditional government-led agencies?
Yeah, I think you've almost answered it there, Anna. I see community conservation is all of the contributions that sit out of government, so like our DOC and our local councils. So a group of people coming together through a shared interest, in this instance, conservation, and practicing sort of common ownership of, you know, an issue, a challenge or an opportunity. And so in the community, that might be iwi hapu, it might be volunteer groups, it might be schools or businesses. So that community sort of factor for contributing. A term that's been frequently used now is a community of practice. And so that's a group of people who share that common interest and learn from one another. And I guess you can think of BCA almost as a facilitator of multiple communities of practice across the region and really helping to make those connections so that those learnings can be really shared.
That's so awesome. Anna and I are involved in a bunch of your community groups that you support, and I'm just constantly blown away by how much people give to their communities, how much time is spent, how much heart and passion and a lot of innovation that comes out of it. But fast forward to today, you started out with this mission to really support communities with their conservation a bit more. What's the purpose and mission of BCA these days?
Yeah, so our vision is that through collaboration, the natural ecosystems and indigenous biodiversity of the Bay of Plenty is restored. So we have a Bay of Plenty wide mandate. And our purpose within that is to support and grow the capability and impact of our communities and partners to restore that indigenous biodiversity and ecosystems. So we're very much about support, providing those support mechanisms for those doing the real mahi on the ground.
Yeah, and I can speak from experience. If you're a smaller group, and like you already mentioned, it's often volunteer-based, you really just want to do the mahi on the ground, what you originally came together to do in the first place in solving these issues. It's just such a relief having help on the admin, because it's not the strength of these groups, is it?
No, absolutely. And I think, yeah, as you say, volunteers want to do the cool stuff. They want to walk the trap line, be in the forest, put the plants in the ground. But, you know, many of the groups are charitable organizations in their own right. And with that comes a huge amount of back-end administration. So the reporting, the where are we getting funding from? How are we keeping up with, you know, the most up-to-date technologies? Have we got our health and safety planning right? Is it compliant? What policies do we need as a board? So those kind of areas, you know, when you've got multiple groups all spending time on those, it isn't efficient and cost-effective. So that was certainly an area for BCA to come in and really try and make more efficient and supported.
That's really awesome. I guess if you're given your free time, you don't necessarily want to be looking after this stuff. But I think it's also important just at this point to mention that conservation volunteering isn't only about doing the species work or walking a trap line. There are a lot of other ways that you can get involved. For example, I help through marketing and building websites and design. Other people help through financial skills like being a treasurer, but that's not always available. And having an umbrella organization like Bay Conservation Alliance specifically is such a benefit for making sure the longevity is there, because so many conservation groups are reliant on a few key individuals, and filling the gaps that aren't necessarily of interest or of capability is just so important.
Yeah, 100% agree with that, Callum. You know, there are many ways that you can support conservation projects and outcomes, and it doesn't have to be in the field. It can be this back end stuff. And some groups are really lucky to have some of those skill sets. Or sometimes we play a role in just filling a gap while it is a gap, for example, with a treasurer, providing a little bit of support around that. And then we can step out again when another good volunteer comes into play, you know, or recognizing where we do need professional support as well. And I think that's an important component, that we recognize that volunteer work is amazing, but let's come in and complement that with professional sort of capability as well where it's appropriate.
Yeah, and I think those are key challenges that every group faces. It's that higher level that we're all forced to comply with. But the other thing that we often talk about is those identities of these groups and how they're all kind of specializing on their little bit. I believe that our strength is if we all work together, we can only achieve the common goal if those small groups join to achieve the bigger picture and unity. What are your thoughts on that? Because that's pretty much one of the other missions of BCA, all right?
Yeah, I think you raised two really, really good kind of points there. So identity, I think, is hugely important here in Aotearoa. You can see it in local groups that sort of local identity is really important to them. You know, each project can have quite a specific identity. And certainly when BCA was first being emerged, I think while there was never any intention of BCA coming in and taking away any of that individual identity, there was certainly some fear of, you know, a new organisation being created and what would that mean? Would we all need to identify as one entity for a region? And we were really conscious of that. And I think that personal identity is really important at that local level. And so we took a lot of care as new kind of groups were learning about us and deciding whether they wanted to become a part of the collective, to make sure that, you know, those individual identities were always honoured and are to this day and will continue to be. And then that second really important part is unity. Yeah, so, you know, for sure, coming together as a collective gives us more strength as a network. It means that our voice for nature is stronger, that we can rely on each other to sort of back one another up when we might have a new idea or there's something that we really want to voice to make change, whether that be on policy or doing other kind of advocacy work. So yeah, unity, I think, brings real strength to the opportunities that we have.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. It's so important and so valuable. And the more we talk to people and conservation and get involved in it, the more we find that relationships are key. You don't want to be working in isolation and a silo. And I've found through your events that you host, coming together and just hearing what other groups are doing and hearing how they do things differently or sharing tips or even just knowing that there's other people, allies on your side, is so important. But stepping outside of the conservation space, I could talk birds and species and trapping all day long and plus some. But for people that aren't actively involved in conservation, what value does BCA bring to the wider Bay of Plenty region?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of it does stem around that connecting and that relationship building. So, yeah, I think personally for me as well, I'm always focused on the relationship side of things, you know, that human to human sort of connection, understanding of one another's aspirations and how we can kind of support and work together. So I think that's really key. I think the other thing that we sort of do is being able to, as a collective, speak on behalf of nature, of the network here in the Bay. So certainly, you know, one of the drivers when Julian was setting this up, there was an MP in Wellington that said, hey, you know, what would be really helpful is if we just had one entity in each region that we could come and talk to, because actually New Zealand's got over 2,000 small community conservation groups. You know, it's a huge volume. You know, what we are amazing is in New Zealand is setting up sort of charitable trusts. I think we've got more per capita than anywhere else in the world, which is amazing in terms of demonstrating our kind of love and drive to own, you know, situations and try and bring about change. But also that's quite challenging in the amount of people that are, say, competing for funding, for people resource, and sort of for a voice. So that was definitely in the back of the mind of, well, if we had an entity that can speak on behalf of the network and it can take information back to that network, then, you know, that's an outcome that an organization like Bay Conservation can play. And I think that that is a real benefit now for the wider Bay of Plenty, that we're in the position to do that and have those meetings with MPs and councillors and look at, you know, submissions collectively or ways in which that we can kind of, yeah, do that more collectively. I'd say another sort of value that we bring to the region is the relationship that we've built with some of the key funders here. So like the TECT and the Bay Trust, some of our, you know, amazing philanthropy funders, and by now sort of having a relationship with them whereby we can complete combined funding applications on behalf of our member groups. So what that does is it provides a benefit to the funder themselves, because they're not experts in the sort of environmental conservation space, but because we have a good working relationship with us, they feel that what we take to them, we're providing an endorsement, that that's a good investment from their perspective. And the fact that we're facilitating that funding for our groups means they don't need to fill out the 20-page funding application, you know, individually, and it makes it a whole lot sort of smoother for them. So I think there's a really nice kind of benefit there. And Callum, like you mentioned around, you know, your role in sort of that marketing communication space, I think that's another benefit that sort of BCA brings to the wider Bay of Plenty sort of community, in us being able to kind of feed social media, bring some collective communication tools together that promote the work of our member groups and our kind of core partners. And that builds awareness then for the whole community in the Bay of Plenty, which hopefully leads to, you know, more involvement in some way, more investment, more volunteers, more kids aspiring to perhaps work in the conservation space in the future.
Yeah, you touched on two important points there that I'd love to just vibe on a little bit more. The first one is you talked about the collective being able to communicate more than a smaller group can by having this collective. To any marketers out there who are listening, communication is really valuable for conservation. And if you like nature and you'd like to help out, I really encourage you to consider talking to one of your local community groups. Any help, even if it's just advice, is usually very gratefully received. So just a little plug to those marketers, you might find it's very fulfilling. I certainly do anyway. But the other point I just wanted to make is I'd like to put myself in the shoes of a local, let's say living in the Mount or in Tauranga or somewhere else in the Bay of Plenty, who's not into conservation, but they like the outdoors, they like nature. There's a lot of stuff we take for granted. We take for granted that these rare shorebirds are on the beach, that the dunes are being planted, or that when we walk in the forest, there's birdsong. And I think there's a lot of unspoken benefits of community conservation and of the role that BCA plays in enabling that community conservation that doesn't quite get credit, that if it wasn't there, we wouldn't have a lot of the stuff. But we just assume that, of course, there's going to be a dawn chorus. Of course, there's going to be bird song. And of course, the forest's going to be healthy. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, we often sort of talk about, you know, what is the level of awareness? I think over the last sort of 5-10 years with other issues like climate change coming into play and being, you know, so much more evident in terms of real live experiences that we're having, you know, right here in our own country, that, yeah, is that awareness kind of building? And to a degree, we think it is. But also life is busy and, you know, people have got lots of things to contend with, and cost of living crisis and, you know, a whole range of different things. So it's, yeah, I guess it's about, as you say, sometimes taking for granted that you're going to go for a walk in a forest and you're going to hear, you know, an amazing bird song. And quite often we walk in a forest here and think, oh my God, there is barely anything here. I hear no sound. And more people kind of need to know that and be aware of that. I mean, here in Tauranga, we've got the Kaimamamuku Conservation Park right on our doorstep. But I would say probably 80% of the population here have never been for a walk in the Kaimamamukus, you know, and it is right on our doorstep. And we are lucky that we've got some pretty special places here. But generally, they still all need a lot of help. And as much community conservation is going on, which is amazing, a lot of biodiversity is still going backwards. So there's still a lot of work, including that awareness raising piece, in order for us to get the right action to be successful.
For sure.
I think awareness and the other key thing you mentioned as well, Michelle, was the funding bit. And it's so nice to, you know, get a tap off the on the shoulder from the, from the bigger organization. Just that reminder of, hey, this is coming up, look into it. That little email sometimes immensely helps to redirect your attention into the right moment again, but also having BCA have the capacity to show up on events. I think that's another key challenge that you're solving for all of us, especially if it involves the younger generation and pointing them into the right direction.
Yeah, for sure.
Is this collective umbrella support model for conservation that you've developed and your team has developed with BCA unique to the Bay of Plenty? Or are there counterparts throughout the country that do a similar job?
Yeah, so Environment Centre started forming in New Zealand about 20 years ago now. So there are a lot of environment centres sitting under Hubs Aotearoa. I think groups like us that were really focused purely on conservation started to emerge more frequently in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. And I see that sort of continuing to grow. So similar entities to us that started around about the same time back in 2017, examples would be Wild for Taranaki, Biodiversity Hawke's Bay, Tasman Environment Trust. Then there are collectives that are really focused, say, specifically on predator-free 2050. So we liaise, say, the Predator-Free Hauraki Coromandel Community Trust. And I think what's awesome is that we are connecting. So we get called regional conservation hubs or, you know, as something sort of along those lines. And while it's really important for us to be collaborating as a region so that we can learn, it's equally important that we collaborate across the regions. And so we do have sort of quite regular online hui, so that we can talk about what's kind of evolving, what's working in our own regions as to whether, you know, that then might work somewhere else or we can learn from that.
Yeah.
I find it really fascinating how everything that we talked about really comes back to the community. It's this grassroots, bottom-up model, stepping in for nature, really, for conservation, where governments failed, where there was just not enough funding and people were like, no, this is special to me. I'm going to fight for this. And you already touched on how many community groups are out there in New Zealand. It's just simply mind-blowing. And it's amazing to create a platform for them. And it's amazing to see that it's now regional-based and hopefully leading up into government changing for the better. So if BCA and the community groups didn't exist, what would happen to our biodiversity?
Yeah, well, I think particularly if the community groups didn't exist, I mean, I would actually hate to think what that looked like. Yeah, I mean, as you've just mentioned, you know, on a daily basis, we're inspired by the communities, you know, doing good things and the passion that they kind of hold. And sometimes it's really hard for them and, you know, we can kind of walk beside them and hopefully help them get through the tough times to come out to the other side. Yeah, I think there's huge power in community, you know, and multiple benefits for those communities beyond just the conservation outcome. So, you know, we all feel better when we connect with like-minded people because it gives us a sense of place and belonging. And you know, sometimes we need that, you know, all our lives, there are different challenges that we face. And so having something that we feel we are giving a positive contribution to the world, and we can tell our grandchildren one day, you know, I started that planting and, you know, look at it now, it's become a forest and actually Kōkako have expanded into it. Or so to lose all of that community passion and drive for me would be, yeah, would be really, really tragic. Let's not land there.
let's not go there. But I guess the other flip side of this question is, if funding wasn't an issue, how else would you like to see BCA helping community conservation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the answer to that question would always be guided by the member group and partner needs and aspirations. So, you know, we try and move and reflect what is needed for us. So we're essentially serving our member groups. I guess key, though, I can see is that if funding was no issue, then in order to really be truly successful from an ecosystems and biodiversity point of view, we need to scale up. We need larger landscape scale projects to really achieve the outcomes that we're looking for. Some community projects can be quite small, and then in time, you'll kind of realize that actually, you know, as my kiwi population, for example, is starting to expand, and those birds need to move out and have more space and to continue breeding and growing that population and thriving, then we need to ensure that there's the habitat around them to support that. So I would say, and I think member groups would be, you know, supportive of this, and not every group wants to expand, and that's fine, but some do. And so I think, yeah, if funding was no limitation, then it would be really looking at the strategic opportunities for those bigger picture landscape scale projects that we could really get behind and support. I think that would be fundamental. The other thing I think is around that skills development and capability building space. So BCA was really fortunate to obtain Jobs for Nature funding. And so for the last 4 years, we've been running the Tauira Mahi Bay Conservation Cadets Program, which Anna was on our first intake.
Yes.
And it's proven hugely successful. It's a 12-week, pretty intense training program for adults going on a career path in conservation. Cadets are paid to be on the program, and it covers a whole range of core skills in the conservation space, your outcomes monitoring, pest control, water, you know, GIS, a whole range of different things. And we've now got cadets all over the country doing amazing mahi. Now, unfortunately, you know, with many Jobs for Nature programs, they're coming to an end. And so our cadet program will finish next year when funding ceases. And that is a shame because we've created quite a unique model that is proving to be really effective. So if funding was no issue, we would potentially continue that program. That being said, we are, as BCA, sort of looking at ways in which we will continue some kind of training support. You know, we've built up really good skills and capability ourselves and have an amazing network of knowledge that we can draw upon. And I think that's really key, just having that network and just enabling those people to share. So it's not about one tutor in front of you for 12 weeks, it's diversity. And so, yeah, just sort of continuing, because we're always going to need that knowledge, those skills in order to achieve the outcomes that we're looking for.
Yeah,
I just really want to back that up, what you just said, Michelle. For me, it, being part of that journey of the cadets, it was very transforming. And it really did make a difference to being able to visit the different member groups. Some of them, to be quite honest, I didn't even know that existed. You kind of, it's an eye opener on how broad conservation can be. You know, you're so focused, like I'm always focused on birds, on plants, and suddenly I was in a stream doing fresh water monitoring, and I wasn't a big fan, but at least I know that now. And making those connections, piecing the puzzle together, it was just so valuable for me. But I also know that these connections you build, they can be for life, and it's good for everyone involved, really, to share knowledge and pass it on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it can change people's lives, you know, in finding the thing that motivates you, that's actually, well, this is my calling. And it might be a specific facet of conservation, or it might be working across the whole lot of it. And I guess, yeah, what we've been looking to do is just give people that kind of taster. But also the focus was connecting that learning to our member group sites, because those member groups, some of them have been going for 30 years. They hold phenomenal knowledge and passion. And so for them to be able to impart that on the cadets, and the cadets go in and support the mahi that those volunteers do, I think that's been sort of one of the, yeah, most sort of beautiful outcomes of that program.
Definitely. Yeah, 100%, and very inspiring too.
Yeah, so I had Anna coming home during that time telling me about all this diverse range of stuff she was doing, and I was a little bit jealous. So yeah. Hearing, you know, one moment you're looking at soil science, the next is GPS and learning how to use GIS, the next you're doing eDNA, or it's amazing. We've looked at what would happen if community and BCA didn't exist. We've looked at what would happen if you had lots and lots of funding and money wasn't an issue. But let's turn to the future for a moment. what role do you see collaboration and collective umbrella groups playing in the future of conservation throughout the country?
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, we've probably sort of touched on that a bit in it's that kind of creating that unity and that collaboration. It's the ability to sort of speak on behalf of the network, on behalf of nature, essentially, and to constantly be, I guess, taking information back to that network and supporting the growth and the development of that network to deliver on the outcomes that we're looking to achieve. You know, hubs can, conservation hubs can really, I guess, help the region be a little bit more strategic. So whether, you know, at the moment we're in a constrained funding time, we're very aware of that having an impact on groups on the ground, you know, right through the chain, essentially. So, you know, we're sort of thinking at the moment around, well, how can we be more sustainable to get through sort of government cycles, and we can't be reliant on some of those systems. So, you know, where are there other funding inputs that we can be exploring and looking for? So, for example, the business sector, you know, research shows that businesses really want to get behind biodiversity, but often they don't know how. So what mechanisms can we help sort of put into place that builds those partnerships, relationships, and opportunities for collaboration? That doesn't have to be just in a funding sense. It might be in a shift in how I operate my business, which actually creates, you know, better ecological outcomes. Or it might be that we allocate some time of our team coming to support community conservation. Or it might be that we sponsor certain sort of facets to a group's work. So I think that kind of strategic and just in harder times, you know, and that might be for an individual group or conservation as a whole, just kind of holding the faith a little bit, keeping the energy up and just kind of walking alongside people when they need it.
Yeah, that's awesome. If you're a business person and you're thinking about how do we get involved in biodiversity a bit more with our operations, I'd just like to mention a report that Sustainable Business Network produced a little while back. I think it was the Regenerating Nature Report. If you go onto Sustainable Business Network's website, it's there. It's very comprehensive and explains how businesses can and are getting involved in biodiversity. And a lot of what you've said, Michelle, is also highlighted as recommendations in that report. So if you're at the earlier stages of this, obviously BCA is great to talk to, but if you just want a quick report on what to do, I'd highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great report, Callum. And that's sort of leading to the work that we're doing here locally in the Bay of Plenty. So we're just starting to partner with Priority One, which is the economic development agency here in the Western Bay of Plenty. We've got a sort of a nature and business type event coming up here in Tauranga in November, which will be the initial sort of opportunity to connect with local businesses here, just to understand what's their position. What information do they need? What are their aspirations? And, you know, what role can we sort of play to start building those connections? So I think that is a really exciting opportunity.
100%. I think awareness and funding are definitely the two key challenges we all face. And I'd love for conservation to just move a little bit away from government, like, so we can actually make long-term plans. Because conservation is a long-term game. That's just plain fact. That's how it works. Nature doesn't work quickly, no matter how we try and turn it. So I'd love to see, you know, 10 and 50-year plans put in place for conservation in Aotearoa. And speaking of long-term plans, what's your 10 or 50-year plan for BCA and the region of the Bay of Plenty?
That's a rather cool question. I would say lots of things. So first, we'd all buy into the value of biodiversity and nature. We wouldn't need to be kind of fighting for that cause anymore, but the awareness would be there. And that would mean that we were making the right decisions at all levels. So the decision makers were on board. And we'd understand that the importance of biodiversity investment. So I think still a lot of decision makers consider, you know, biodiversity a cost and choose not to go down that path. But really, it's an investment that is just multiple benefits if we really, you know, sort of treat it the right way. I think we'd be planning across many community sectors and generations. So exactly like you've just said, Anna, this is, you know, we've taken quite some time to degrade a lot of our planet, and it's going to take some time to recover as well. So we need to be thinking intergenerationally. We need to have those long-term plans that we commit to. And of course, we can adapt and evolve pending on progress, but over time. I think I would love to see sort of Māori whakapapa and customs recognised, well, flourishing, and so those traditions passed on through the generations, and not concerned that we're losing them, because actually, you know, there is no kai to go and gather anymore, and so those customs are lost. We'd be achieving visions like predator-free 2050, and maybe moving on from that. Imagine if we could get to the place where the predators were removed from Aotearoa. It makes our conservation journey so different and so unique to anywhere else in the world. I know, obviously from the UK, but been here. I'm privileged to live here for 22 years now. But, you know, I came having studied conservation, was super motivated to come and work and live in a country that, you know, I saw as being a leading entity in conservation. And then arriving and working for DOC initially, and realizing that actually the focus of conservation is killing things. And that took me quite a while to get my head around, because it wasn't really what I was expecting. It's quite unique and different. But imagine if we get that in check and then we actually focus on the positives. I think that would be an amazing place to be in the future. If all our rivers were swimmable again, I mean, who wouldn't want that?
I totally vibe and agree with everything you just said.
Imagine it.
Yeah, it'd be so amazing, because coming from Germany, and when I started conservation here, I had the same, oh, hedgehogs are not my friends anymore moment. And it does take time to adopt that mindset and understand the whys behind it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah,
I think one of the points you raised a few times was the intergenerational aspect. If we zoom out and we look at conservation in the longer term picture, is succession. One thing, and that's important from a lot of different angles. One of the things I see is that a lot of our community groups are led by a few individuals, and those individuals are committed. They're often retired and they have the time to give, and I take my hat off to them. But the people that have been involved for 20 or 30 years aren't going to be around forever. And succession of our communities, succession of our customs and traditions, and succession of, you know, all capabilities within this space is so important. It's important that we have a new stream of people coming through. And the cadet program you did was so useful for that. But I think a lot of our conversation has been talking about organizational things and stuff that an individual is really might be interested in, but can't action straight away. So let's just take a look at the practical tips. Do you have any practical tips on how people can help nature today, tomorrow, when they have a moment, when they're curious?
Yeah, I think as an individual, just look at what your own superpower is, and that's different for everybody. So, you know, like you said, you don't have to be wearing a cape. But, you know, you might be the one that's motivated to go and walk the trap line, but you might not, and that's okay. And so, you know, if you've been an accountant all your life and you've retired, but you've got skills and you've actually got time and you might have an interest in the environment, then there's going to be a group that needs your help for sure. You know, so I think it's just looking at what skills do you have that you can bring to the table, and just looking at how you individually can help.
I love that, and it's never too late to discover your superpower for conservation, that's for sure.
No, totally. Yeah, I think often you kind of think, oh, well, I've got nothing to give, but actually we've all got something to give, and it's just, yeah, it's identifying that thing, you know, and that might evolve and change over life as well, but, you know, what have you got to give in that at that point?
It can be quite novel what you can give as well. I mentioned this on a previous podcast episode, but there's at Te Reo Matangi, they have these beanies which have different native birds knitted into them, and that was, as I understand it, it was people that decided that they would use knitting as their superpower to raise money and awareness for conservation. And Anna just got into knitting and has been knitting these beanies for all our friends and family. And you would not think that knitting beanies could be a funding and awareness raiser, but it is. And I wear it everywhere. And the amount of comments I get on this hat is phenomenal.
It's an amazing conservation starter, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's it. And it's sometimes those really unique things also that create the conversation, create the awareness raising. So, yeah, okay, we might be putting an order in then, Anna, for a Christmas supply.
You're going to be busy.
No pressure.
No pressure.
I'll bring the book to the next board meeting. You can all have a look.
Sounds brilliant.
So conservation means different things to everyone. Really curious to know, Michelle, what does conservation mean to you?
I think it means hope. Yeah, I think just that sort of idea of being able to preserve the unique kind of biodiversity that we have, particularly here in Aotearoa, where we are so unique through such high endemism and, you know, amazing, amazing stuff that is here. It is only here, nowhere else in the world. So I think, you know, conservation, you naturally think conserving, preserving, protecting. But yeah, that needs to be backed up by hope. And the idea that actually we can do this collectively.
I love that. And I think hope drives us all, and hope brings out our superpowers. And it also, you know, weaves us together for that unity that we talked about. And another question we're curious asking, we've talked a lot about biodiversity and ecosystems today. Yeah. So what does that look like? What does a healthy ecosystem look like in your eyes?
I think a lot of it is about bringing everything back into equilibrium. So, you know, so much is out of equilibrium right now. We're out of balance. And so it's bringing that back. You know, a healthy ecosystem, everything needs to function, you know, with its own individual roles, and then collectively, you know, that creates the system that thrives. So I think, yeah, the more we can do to bring that alignment back is hugely helpful. Yeah, I mean, a healthy system ultimately supports the well-being of us as humans, as people. You know, we rely on, you know, healthy water, food system, a space to go and explore nature and take time out and feel well. So just, yeah, bringing that equilibrium back to the ecosystem probably then brings some equilibrium and some balance back to our own lives as well.
Definitely. And I think the first thing about bringing things into equilibrium is understanding what equilibrium is. You know, equilibrium isn't having a forest that has no understory. Equilibrium also isn't being glued to our phones all day. We didn't evolve to be working all hours and glued onto technology, and our native ecosystems didn't evolve to be eaten out by pests. So I think understanding what the potential is, and that comes back to hope, is, you know, once we know what we actually want as a people, we can make it happen. With a final question to wrap up, how can people get involved and support your mahi and conservation in the Bay of Plenty?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing and the easiest thing is just to look at what's available in your local area. So, you know, it's nice to connect to something that's right in your community, you know, if that's possible. So if you live in Rotorua, then, you know, shout out to groups like Kaharoa Kōkako Trust. If you live in Te Puke, then Utane Wanuki Kiwi Trust is just up the road. And if you're in Katikati, you know, Ongatiti Forest Project is just up the road. So I guess it's, you know, and some people will want to travel further for something that specifically inspires them. But if there's something local, then, you know, it's easier for you to get to. It's kind of part of your own, the fabric of your community. So, you know, if you're looking, then the Bay Conservation website, www.bayconservation.nz, is a great resource, because we profile a lot of our member groups on there. We've got an events calendar. We've got links to groups, Facebook pages, and so on. Or follow our Facebook page. We try and share what our member groups are up to, or kind of interesting kind of information and activities that are occurring. So that's a great place to just find information, yeah, and just network locally and see what kind of what you can get involved in.
Yeah, we'll put the links in the show notes below, but I think getting involved locally is such a good one. If you have to drive for 2 hours each way to do your volunteering, it creates a barrier that just makes it harder to make the commitment and build the habit if it's down the road.
It's less easy to be sustainable, you know, and we kind of acknowledge that, you know, people have got constraints and, you know, so I think if you can find something that works in and is easy achievable for you to commit, and I guess, you know, remembering that, you know, some of us will commit for 30 years, other of us may kind of commit for one activity or for a few months, and all of it is valuable. So I think don't hold back just because you think, well, I'm going overseas next year, I'd love to get involved, but I've only got 8 months. Well, that 8 months could be a hugely valuable contribution, you know, or those 2 days where a group needs extra boots on the ground, or just to help set up, you know, a website or whatever it might be. So yeah, I think all contributions are valued, and yeah, don't hold back.
It's been such a pleasure having you on here, Michelle. Yeah, really appreciate your time.
Thank you for sharing what BCA does for the region and chatting about the key challenges and hope, which is so important. Definitely check out the website and the different member groups if you're keen and not already involved. It's a great tool to see what's out there and find your right fit.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for having me, guys. It's been lovely to chat to you today.
Cool.
No, thank you.
Thank you.